Okay, well, thank you. Whenever I'm the last speaker at a meeting like this, it's particularly appropriate since Morris is from the Washington area, to start with a remark that's often used in the United States Senate when people are discussing or debating things. And that is, you might think at a meeting like this that everything that could be said about neutrinos has been said. And you're right, but not everybody's had a chance to say it. So now I'm having my chance. Now, when I talk about very long baseline oscillation experiments, the ideas I'm talking about started a couple of years ago from Maurice Goldhaber's 90th birthday, when I was asked to talk about proton decay. And Maurice once suggested many years ago that the ultimate proton decay experiment would be on the moon, because eventually we'd hit neutrino backgrounds in the detector, which is the ultimate background that people will hit probably with another factor of 10 or so. So he said, build the final big detector on the moon where there aren't any cosmic ray neutrinos, only some coming from the Earth. And so for his celebration of his 90th birthday, I gave a talk on proton decay, and then thought about sending a neutrino beam. If they had this huge detector up on the moon, why not send a neutrino beam to it? And so I worked out all of the oscillation parameters, and it was actually doable. There was only one problem. The moon doesn't stand still, it moves. So you've got to track it like a telescope. However, as a result, I started thinking about very long baselines and what kind of physics you could do. And this is what I mean by a very long baseline. I actually call it extra long baseline. The reason I call it extra long is because the natural energy for neutrinos from Brookhaven has traditionally been around 1 GeV. And the oscillation peak with a 1 GeV beam is around 500 kilometers, which would be around over here somewhere. But no one's going to build a big detector in this part of the country. No one's ever discussed it. However, people have talked about WIP, this underground storage facility, and certainly Homestake, and out here in the Rockies or in California, etc. And so this became known to me, at least, as extra long baseline, because it's about five times longer than you would have normally thought of building a baseline. And the interesting thing was, it turns out that to do CP violation was essentially independent of the distance. So if you wanted to do a CP violation experiment, whether you did it at 500 kilometers or 2,500 kilometers, statistically didn't matter. And so that I thought that this was very interesting, because it said wherever somebody builds a beam, a detector, a big detector, it has to be a big detector, that you can send a beam to it from Brookhaven or Fermilab and do just as good on CP violation as you would have done if you had optimized the location of the detector for CP violation. Now, you don't do as well on everything else because the flux is falling off like 1 over distance squared. So CP violation is very special because you can put up with that fall off in the flux, because for most values of parameters, as you go to larger distances, the asymmetries, the CP violating asymmetries, get bigger and they grow linearly. And so that there's a trade-off, linear growth of the symmetries versus 1 over L squared fall off of flux, and they cancel because the symmetries are more important. Your figure of miracle is like the asymmetry squared. That's why it works. For theta-1-3, it's not true. For theta-1-3, if that's your goal, to measure theta-1-3, you just lose the flux in doing all of this. So what I'm talking about is an optimization for CP violation. However, it turns out it does actually very well on theta-1-3 as well. So I'll talk about that. In fact, more or less by trial and error, as a working group at Brookhaven got into this, that's been meeting for about a year or so, we realized, even though we started out just looking for CP violation, the sort of project that we came up with that I'll be telling you about, that's under this long baseline neutrino oscillations, actually had the potential to measure everything about the 3x3 matrix, see very large matter effects, measure these three angles, measure the phase delta without any ambiguity, the type that we heard of today, just a direct measurement of the phase delta, and measure the two delta m squareds rather precisely. So I'm going to make this kind of provocative, particularly since I'm the last speaker here. No one can contradict me following this. And I'm going to talk about doing precision measurements of all of this in one experiment over a finite time, like 5 years, instead of 20 years or 30 years or any amount of time like that. Our study is mainly using muon neutrino beams to study two oscillations, nu mu to nu mu, okay, disappearance, and nu mu to nu e appearance. We may do anti-neutrinos, but it's not necessary for these measurements, or probably not necessary for these measurements. That means we're not really going to measure CP violation, because in doing these studies, we realized you don't have to measure CP violation. If you're working within a framework like this 3x3, you can just measure delta instead. Okay, and so that's what I'll be mainly talking about. The parameters that we think we already know from atmospheric, people have talked about, the delta M32 squared has been moving down since we started our study. It's now at around 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3, but with big errors. The study we're talking about will measure this to better than 1% statistically, and the only thing that will limit the measurement is how well the detector can be calibrated. Otherwise, you could do better than 1%. It'll measure sine squared 2 theta 2 3 to also about 1%. If it's near 1.0, it'll tell you that it's within 1% of 1, the 45 degrees, to about 99% probability. The solar parameters that Camland was also measured have moved in a very interesting direction for us. Delta M21 squared has gone from the 5 we started with to around 7 times 10 to the minus 5 EV squared. Sine squared 2 theta 1's moved up a little since we started our study. We would also claim that this experiment I'm going to talk about can measure these to about 5 to 10%. This will be measured in the new mu to new E channel. These will be measured in the new mu to new mu channel. Okay. The two that aren't known now, theta 1, 3, and delta, can be measured to some degree. If theta 1, 3 is between sine squared of 0.01 and 0.20, we'll do a measurement. If it's below that, we can provide a bound of around 0.005, roughly the kind of bounds other people talk about with typical neutrino beams, very intense neutrino beams. The backgrounds start to get to you at around that level. In the terms of the phase delta, they can be between 0 and 2 pi. Our trick is we measure both sine delta and cosine delta. That's why we don't have any ambiguity. And we'll measure delta not if it's just maximal, as sometimes has been suggested, but we'll measure to plus or minus 20 degrees, even if delta is 0, because we're going to measure cosine as well as sine in all of this. So from our point of view, there's a lot more potential to conventional beams than people have so far talked about. In terms of the J parameter, the parameterized CP violation, the product of all of these that we sometimes call the prize, it's potentially very large, and we should measure this to about 25%. Of course, if some of the parameters are unusually small and this is looking like it's zero, we'll just give a bound on it. This is to be compared with the J coming from the quark sector, which is known to be very tiny, 3 times 10 to the minus 5. In fact, if these numbers are measurable and not just bounded, we'll probably measure the J of leptonic CP violation, which is the invariant parameterization of the degree of CP violation, as well as we currently know the quarks. And that's quite something, to go from not knowing anything about leptonic mixing to knowing the degree of CP violation as well in the two systems within, say, the next 10 years would be truly amazing. How far we go here is not known. I think B physics and kaon physics can get to about 7% ultimately. Okay. We know that parts of the leptonic mixing are large. So it's very possible, perhaps even most likely, that this thing is relatively large. In fact, the idea that theta 1-3 is really, really tiny comes about, I would say, mainly because of a theoretical perspective. We know it's relatively small compared to the others, so what do? We don't know how to predict any of these things, so we write down mass matrices that we diagonalize, and we intentionally set them so that we'll get zero, because it's how we get small numbers. Small numbers are supposed to be zero for us. And then we look at little perturbations and see what we get, and we get small numbers, because we start out sort of at zero in our mindset. But really, no one has any idea what theta 1-3 is. So how far we're going over here in an experiment like this is a matter, seems to me, of taste, of how you gauge it. I look at going from 0.20 to 0.01 to say we're covering 95% of the allowed space of sine squared 2 theta 1-3. Someone else could look at it and say, but I really believe it's below 0.01, and that's where all of the action is. So one can't argue about that. Now, from this one experiment, we claim you can measure everything, potentially everything, and then search for new physics, And we heard very interesting talks about sterile neutrinos and extra dimensions, etc., which really separates leptonic mixing and oscillation experiments from the quark sector. In the quark sector, we're trying to measure everything precisely to compare B physics against B physics against K physics, and look for new loop effects, primarily, maybe tree level effects. Here we're looking for really an entirely different kind of physics that could impact what we think we're supposed to see in oscillations. I think that's pretty exciting. Now, the figure of merit for doing an experiment that I'm going to describe in a few minutes goes like delta M21 squared squared. So as delta M21, the solar number, gets bigger and bigger, which seems to be happening with Camland, our experiment gets easier and easier. And it goes like 1 over delta M32 squared, the atmospheric one, squared. So as this gets smaller, our experiment gets easier and easier. This is probably the only experiment that actually gets easier as delta M32 squared gets smaller. Everybody else sort of sees it's going down as a disaster. For us, it's great. We're also proportional to sine squared 2 theta 1 2. Of course, the figure of merit is proportional to the detector size, the beam power, the amount of time we run, cross sections, etc. But these are the important parameters. When we started this study, these were the central values we used. This was on the low side, and this one was on the high side. This was a little bit lower than people might use today. And we concluded to do CP violation, we needed a 500 kiloton detector, a 1 megawatt beam, not quite a super beam, sort of a little bit sub-super, because we don't think you can build what's called a super beam, not with 4 megawatts of power at least. And we needed to run for about 5 snowmass years, which seems reasonable. Now those parameters, now in 2003, are about 3 times bigger than we thought back then. We could descope the experiment a little bit, but we were not that robust, and we think you should still stick with these parameters. And the experiment is now easier by a factor of 3, if you like, or more robust by a factor of 3. Now if we move to the LMA2 solution, which is up by another factor of 2 of delta M, to 1 squared, we gain a factor of 4, making this experiment 4 times easier, meaning we'd be about 13 times easier than we started the study. And at that point, we would start to think about descoping by maybe not upgrading the beam, not going even with a super beam, but a regular beam, for example. So I hope LMA2 is right, but we won't know. So the outline of my talk, it's mainly an advertisement for this effort, and so I may start sounding like a used car salesman, but what I'm really doing is trying to give away a Lexus to everyone, and not trying to sell you a bill of goods. I know this. I'm going to only talk about a few physics points, those that I think people tend to confuse, even people who are very knowledgeable in this field. So I'm going to say a few words about neutrino superbeams. I studied this a few years ago and gave a very controversial seminar at Brookhaven, so some people don't talk to me there anymore as a result of this, where I claimed that conventional beams had more neutrinos in them than neutrino factories. So I'll say a word about that. Conventional beams just mean you get your neutrinos from pion decay. So they're very easy to get. The technology is very simple, etc. Then I'll talk about CP violation. This is based on a preprint I wrote a couple of years ago on how to measure delta. And the claim that this is probably well known, or should be well known to most people who work on CP violation or neutrino oscillations in general, that your ability to measure sine of delta is insensitive to what the actual value of theta 1-3 is, as long as it's roughly in this region. Okay. And it's also insensitive as to whether you sit on the first peak or the second peak or the third peak as a first approximation. So that means for a given energy, you can go to very large distances, it's what I said originally, and continue to do just as well in CP violation. It's what I call extra long baselines. Now, to me, high energy physicists sometimes are a little bit arrogant when we say we can measure theta 1-3 but we need $3 billion. I don't know if anyone's going to give us $3 billion to measure theta 1-3. And so from my perspective, an experiment like the next generation neutrino experiment, that's going to cost certainly in the hundreds of millions of dollars, has to be combined with a real robust physics program. So again, as a starting point, we assume that you're going to combine this experiment with a large underground detector. Since we need 500 kilotons, and the next generation proton decay experiment needs 500 kilotons or more, it's very natural to combine the two efforts. Now, that effort, the big detector, 20 to 40 times the size of Super K, has its own physics program, proton decay. You know, it's as predicted by Susie Guts, you might see it. Supernova neutrinos, measuring hundreds of thousands potentially of events, seeing relic neutrinos left over from old supernovas, doing things like monopole searches, NN-bar, you know, things that real long shots, but you should do. Atmospheric neutrinos is a given. They've shown they can do that. Next, what they'll do is they'll show the oscillation pattern when they get higher statistics and bigger detectors so that they can have contained higher energy muons. Maybe they'll look for high energy sources that are too low in energy for ice cube, but with a big detector like this and using the rock, etc. What they were missing, though, at least in the United States here, was a very long baseline experiment, and we think that these ideas provide for them the missing ingredient to make their program complete. And so what we would propose is not a neutrino oscillation experiment taken in isolation that costs $500 million, etc., but a long baseline oscillation experiment that's part of this complete program. Okay, and I'll say more about that at the end of the talk. I'll then talk about our specific study. And Milan Dewan, who's done a lot of work on this, sent me about 40 transparencies yesterday, so I'll just show some of them. There's a very powerful physics case that's developing. Now, I happen to have a particular appreciation for proton decay, but certainly I think everyone would agree that if it's seen, it would be a revolutionary discovery. Again, it's somewhat of a long shot when you only can cover a factor of 20 or 30, beyond where we are today. But a lot of the other things are given that we know we can get good physics out of them. So let me start by talking about these neutrino superbeams, which are conventional horn-generated beams, but more intense usually, where you just take your proton source, put it on a target, and use electromagnetic focusing to get out pions going down a beam pipe, and when they decay, with about a 200 meter decay length, you get a high energy new mu beam. Usually, though, it's, say, a Brookhaven, it would be peaked at around 1 to 1.5 GeV, but it has a high energy component and a low energy piece. It's very efficient. Most people don't realize just how efficient this type of technology is. You get around 0.15 neutrinos per proton on target, so the neutrinos coming out are only down by about a factor of 7 compared to the protons going in. A neutrino factory has some very beautiful properties to it. However, you're getting the neutrinos from the muon. So first the pions have to decay. You're using the low energy pions rather than the high energy pions that you used here. So you take a hit in losing some of these. You've got to capture and cool them, and then you get about one third of them in a straight section. So roughly speaking, what people have done so far, they may improve in the future, they get around 0.03 neutrinos per proton on target. And so in this sense, conventional beams have more neutrinos than factories. Now, factories have other advantages that we've heard of. They're clean. You can accelerate to high energies and take advantage of the cross section. When you do that, you also get a small opening angle, etc. If theta 1/3 is really, really tiny, they're probably the only way we know to get at it. So they have a lot of nice advantages. But don't forget, conventional beams are very efficient. You get lots of neutrinos out of them. Because of that, people never talk about 2 GeV muon storage rings or 3, because they know they are not competitive with the superbeam. You only get competitive when you accelerate to high energies. Now, sometimes you can take advantage of that energy, like in theta 1/3. Sometimes it's hard for other kinds of physics to use the full higher energy. So sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. I certainly think that they'll have their place, but I think before we actually get to them, we have one or two more experiments to do with conventional beams. So what does this conventional beam look like? This is roughly the spectrum that you get for a conventional beam. And you can see it's peaked at around 1 GeV or so. If you go on axis, which means just straight down the beam pipe at 0 degrees, you get this kind of spectrum. As you go off axis, something that people seem to be enamored with now, you start to get a narrower band beam peaked at around 1 GeV over here. But you're giving up something, you're giving up flux. This is the AGS case. Here you're giving up about a factor of 2 or more in flux. Now, if you're doing an experiment where you have a 500 kiloton detector, if you give up a factor of 2 in flux, it means you have to go to a 1,000 kiloton detector to compensate, which costs not $500 million, but $1 billion. And so you don't want to give up factors of 2. So we immediately went to the wideband beam rather than the narrowband beam for that reason. Okay, and I think what our studies will show is that everyone should consider the wideband beam. Okay, what the neutrinos that come out of here, the high energy ones can give you deep and elastic scattering. The low energy ones tend to give you what's called quasi-elastic scattering. Quasi-elastic scattering, which dominates at around 1 GeV, is particularly interesting for neutrino physics because what you do is you measure the energy of the outgoing lepton and reconstruct the energy of the neutrino. So you don't have to know the initial neutrino energy, you reconstruct it event by event in this way. If you're doing deep and elastic scattering where there's a muon plus X in the final state, you can't reconstruct the energy that way, and so you have to know the spectrum better. So we know what the energy was up to around 10%, which is the resolution here, by doing this. You also see that for quasi-elastic cross-sections, they rise very quick as you go above a few hundred MeV. You can't use the real low energy ones to do this trick because there's Fermi motion that distorts things. But once you get up above around a half a GeV, you can use this. You see the problem with antineutrinos. If you're working below 1 GeV, the cross-section is very small for antineutrinos, but it then grows somewhat. In the case of neutrinos, it grows faster up to here. By the time you get to 1 GeV, you're sort of at the peak in all of this. So this is roughly the process we want to use to reconstruct the energy of the oscillating neutrinos. So we look for muon events, and we look for electron events. Now that spectrum we're going to use in the process comes from what some people have called a super beam. At Brookhaven, we have 24 GeV protons, and we make around 4 times 10 to the 13 per second on target, so we get around the 0.14 power beam. Fermilab's main injector is higher energy, they have less protons, but they get about a 0.25 megawatt beam. Both places have talked about upgrades to get to between 1 and 2 megawatts, which means you get 7 to 10 times more neutrinos with the super beam. That's a big factor because of what I said about factors of 2 in this game. In Japan, they've talked about starting with a 0.7 megawatt beam and upgrading to 4 megawatts. For us, 4 megawatts would be great, but it's a different experiment because people haven't shown that you can build horns that can focus neutrinos when you put this much power on a target. The whole subject is much different when you go to this kind of a power, so it's much harder. They already have a detector at 295 kilometers, so that's their working base length. The detector is the 22 kiloton super K, and they talk about looking for new mu to new E search with the first stage of this and getting down very low. They're a very good theta 1-3 experiment. When they go after CP violation, they've made very nice studies for stage 2. But what they find is they need 4 megawatts of power. They need a 1,000 kiloton detector. They need 2 years of running neutrinos and 6 years of running antineutrinos because of the smaller cross-section to do CP violation. This is a major, major effort to try to do this. And the cost of a 1,000 kiloton detector and the time to excavate for a 1,000 kiloton detector are very prohibitive. So I view that as very difficult. On the other hand, it's the best that's been put forward, I would say, to now. Now, some time ago, I studied whether there was any chance for the US to compete with this. And I concluded there's one weakness that this experiment has. It's the distance, 295 kilometers is too short. Because of the short distance, they went off axis, which reduces the flux by at least a factor of 2 or so. In addition, because of the distance, they work with neutrinos at around 0.6 GeV, where the cross-section is lower. These factors add up, if you put them all together, to say that if you optimize for CP, you can do better than them by about a factor of 8 or so. And that's why our experiment only takes half the size of the detector, takes 1/4 of the proton source, and instead of 8 years, it runs for 5 years. In addition, we only use neutrinos because we're not going to really measure CP. We're going to measure the phase. All right. So how do we do better? We go to longer distances. The one advantage the US has is we're a big country, so you can go thousands of kilometers. We go on axis and get more flux. We go to higher energy, and we use the whole beam between 0.5 wideband to around 5 GeV. Those are our advantages. So what happens? Let me talk about the physics of neutrino oscillations, although this is one you've seen over and over today, so I can avoid most of the discussion. Here's the matrix. Here's the nu mu to nu mu disappearance experiment. It's dominated by this thing that we think is 1 times this oscillation, where the peaks, or in this case the valleys, because it's a disappearance of this thing, are at 500 kilometers, 1500 kilometers, 2500 kilometers, etc. Or if you fix the distance, say at 2500 kilometers, what it means is that you're going to get different oscillation peaks for different energies of the neutrino, and it looks like this. If we have a beam that goes from 0.5 GeV to 5 GeV, this is the oscillations that we expect to see. So we'll see 1, 2, perhaps a third peak in the oscillations this way. If you want to know where's the best place to measure delta M squared, it's where the slope is greatest, so these points over here. That's why we can do so precise on delta M squared. But one can also measure the mixing angle through this. I'll show you a figure in a minute. But this is a very powerful way of measuring delta M squared and the mixing angle. And you measure it at different energies. So if something weird is happening, like neutrinos are oscillating into extra dimensions or sterile, etc., you'll find different delta M squareds at different energies when you measure this. That's part of the reason you want to measure this oscillation pattern, instead of just watching it go up or something like that. Now here's the appearance experiment. It has 4 primary terms. This one that goes like sine squared 2 theta 1 3, that we think is the dominant one until theta 1 3 gets really tiny. Then it has this one that goes like sine of delta, that changes sign when we go from neutrinos to antineutrinos. The cosine one is about the same size, roughly speaking. Its only difference is this one goes like a sine squared of this oscillating quantity. This goes like sine cosine, so this one changes sign and tends, if you integrate over everything, gets wiped out. Or I think, as was said this morning, if you sit at a peak, the cosine piece is 0, and you don't see this piece at the peak. Otherwise, your ability to measure the sine and the cosine in the method I'm talking about are roughly the same. Then there's the piece that comes from solar neutrinos. That's usually too small for anyone else to see, but because we go to such large distances, this thing is not negligible for us, and so it's there. Then there are smaller terms in their matter effects that we put into the simulations, but I'm not going to talk about because they just distort your ability to see the physics behind this. So the first term goes like sine squared theta 1 3 or 2 theta 1 3. And in terms of the length dependence, you see this thing just goes back and forth between 0 and 1, 0 and 1. The second term only is linear, goes like sine theta 1 3, the term that has the sine delta in it. And the cosine just goes like sine theta 1 3 cosine delta. And the last term, the solar one, has no theta 1 3 suppression in it. The second term goes like the distance, if we take the sine term over here, the small delta m squared, and just replace sine by this its argument over here. This one increases with distance for fixed e, or if you like, for fixed l, the smaller e gets, the bigger this thing is. I'm sorry. Okay. So this one grows essentially for fixed e like l, and this one grows like l squared. So you can see what happens as you go to larger and larger distances. Now let me consider e fixed. The flux factor goes down like 1 over l squared. All right. So this one goes down like 1 over l squared. This one just goes down like 1 over l. This one goes down like 1 over l. And this one doesn't go down at all as you go to further distance. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, that's one way to see why you're independent of sine theta 1 3 and the distance in all of this. Because if the first term is your primary signal, okay, then the square root of that first term is like the variation of your primary signal. And what you're looking for are those perturbations on the signal, the sine delta, the cosine delta, and the solar neutrino one. So you take those perturbations divided by the square root of the sine squared theta 1 term. And what you find, and I'll do it only for the sine delta piece over here, is you find that if you take the square root of the sine squared, you get sine. And this one goes like sine, so it cancels. And so your ability to measure that sine theta 1 doesn't depend on sine theta 1 3 in this approximation, where this is the dominant piece over here. Similarly, it doesn't depend on the distance by the same argument. However, you want to be at an oscillation maximum, because the significance of this thing goes like the sine over here. But it means you can sit at the first peak, the second peak, or the third peak. It doesn't matter, up to this approximation. All right?
Bill, sorry,
oh, yeah, I'll show pictures. Okay, so far I'm just trying to get why we don't care about theta 1-3. Thank you. All right, so that's what this says. Now, in the case of the solar piece, as we go to larger distances, our ability actually improves, it grows, because those things are going like L squared. All right. If you think of this in terms of an asymmetry, the difference of the oscillation between neutrinos and antineutrinos versus the sum of the two, then what you find is that the asymmetry grows like 1 over sine theta 1-3. This is the discussion we had with Lincoln the other day. And the figure of merit for doing an asymmetry experiment goes like the asymmetry squared times the number of events divided by 1 minus the asymmetry squared. So if you're fortunate enough to put yourself at a peak where the asymmetry is near 1, you're gold. Then it's trivial to do asymmetry measurements. If, on the other hand, the denominator is not so important, and this is all statistics I'm talking about so far, then what you can show, again, is you're independent of the distance, as long as you sit at a peak, and you're independent of theta 1-3. Until theta 1-3 gets so small that this approximation breaks down. Okay. So realizing that, we said, we would like to work at a peak where the asymmetry is roughly 1. So we went and found what peaks exist. The number of peaks your experiment will cover as a function of distances here. So Brookhaven to Homestake, for example, you see 4 peaks. So we have a chance, as we go down, the asymmetry gets bigger, to sit at one of these peaks. Okay. So we did 2 things. Engineering studies, which I won't talk much about. Here's what you have to do to the AGS. You have to replace our booster by a LINAC to put more protons into it, and then you get a big increase, and that costs you $270 million, and a beamline costs you $90 million. And the novel feature of our beamline, which I think future beamlines will all imitate, is it's above ground. We build a hill rather than a hole. Holes are more expensive than hills. So what you do is you construct a 15-story hill, and you put your beam pointed at 11 degrees down here. If you try to build something on Long Island going at 11 degrees down 200 meters, you'll find problems for yourself. So you don't want to do that. And this is the artist's rendition of what it will look like in 3D. We run for 5 years with this thing with the big detector. We get around 52,000 events if there's no oscillations. 17,000 in the quasi-elastic channel. So there's a lot of events to keep people busy. Now we look at what do you actually see experimentally. So let me show you the new mu disappearance. This is what you see. You see, if there were no oscillations for this 13,000 with oscillations, 6,000 events. These are the different points. You see the first oscillation peak. This is disappearance, remember. Second oscillation. The third, the resolution is such that you're losing it. You measure the slopes here, and that's how you know delta M31 squared so precisely. How well do you do compared to, say, what we know now? Here's what we know from super K in terms of sine 2 theta and delta M squared. Here's what Minos will tell us, these red circles. As this number goes down, Minos sensitivity gets bad. That's why I said it's a disaster for them. You see, we get better as it goes down. If the sine squared is really near 1, this is what we measure. And so it's very, very precise. All right, let me skip some of these. Now, the evolution of our study. Here's roughly the oscillations you expect to have happen at this homestake, 2,500 kilometers, as a function of different angles. I don't know if you can read them. These are different phases. Okay, so everything else fixed at canonical parameters. Here's what it looks like. So if you only measure the oscillations at one point, you get all of this confusion that we heard of. Some of these may overlap with one another, etc. But if you measure this thing from a half a GeV out to 5 GeV, this is, again, without the matter effect so far, the potential you have are these enormous peaks. and these enormous differences between different phases. The difference between 45 degrees and 135 degrees, the sine is the same. So you're seeing differences here from the cosine term that are at work. That's what the enormous differences are due to. So what we propose is to use, okay, the high energy beam, the high energy part has a very large matter effect in it. In fact, the matter effect enhances the signal by a factor of 2 in this region for the normal ordering, and it makes this signal 0. So we can't miss the matter effect in this region. Okay, it'll be double the signal or make it 0, basically. So that's trivial to do. We'll also use the enhancement if we have the normal hierarchy, and that's what's working for neutrinos. We'll use that region to measure sine squared 2 theta 1 3 because we have a matter enhancement, and that's how we do as well as anyone else. We only use that region for the measurement. The 1 to 3 GeV region we use to measure sine delta and cosine delta, and there's not much matter effect there. And we use the low energy region where we have background, but we're very sensitive to this parameter. So if this quantity is really twice the size, let's say the second LMA solution, we're very, very sensitive to it. Okay. So we have good statistics. We don't need high statistics because these measurements are actually very easy to do. So we do them all with about 100 events, 150 events in each one of those regions, roughly speaking. I'm not going to show you the details because I'm running out of time, but I'll show you something of what the study looks like. This is our NUI appearance. These parameters are smaller parameters. The signal with new parameters will be bigger than all of this. But you can see, it's like doing 20 different experiments that we heard about this morning. Different experiments for different energies. Moving the detector to 20 different locations, effectively, and measuring all of these things. How well will we do in theta 1-3? 10%. Oh, easy. In the high energy part, 5%. In the low energy region, 10. But we've used all 10 here. Okay, here's how we do. Nobody can get down here. The lower the delta M squared is, we do better than all of the other efforts talked about. As delta M squared goes higher, we do worse. But like I said, this experiment was not created for theta 1-3. It was created assuming somebody else, like the JHF people, had measured theta 1-3. How do we do in CP violation? Here's a plot of theta 1-3 versus the phase delta, and this is what we get, 90%, 68% confidence level. Some people might say, you picked 45 degrees because it's particularly good for this study, but you pick anything else and you can see the ellipses are essentially unchanged. Consistent with what I said, that it doesn't really depend what the value of theta 1-3 is. This is the sensitivity you get. You don't have these degeneracies, basically. If the number happens to be 0, you measure 0 up to some uncertainty, like plus or minus 20 degrees. That's what you measure, because you got sine and you got cosine coming into all of this. There are backgrounds that were mentioned this morning. Pi zeros and beam contamination are the worst ones. We studied the pi zeros. They're all at low energy, practically all at low energy. So we would claim above 1 GeV or 1.5 GeV, we don't have a pi zero background problem. Okay, I'm going to skip a lot of these. You can find them on the web. What if theta 1-3 is really zero for some unknown reason? What do we see? Well, this is what we see. We still have a signal because we have the solar signal, but most of it's at low energies. Okay. If the LMA2 solution is right, we see a huge signal above backgrounds, and we mainly do solar parameter measurements, and we're better then, much better than even CAMLAND is. Okay, so, but that's a case where you have zero angle, pessimistic. So here's a summary of our study. I've skipped a lot of the details, but like I said, you can look up the white paper. We think you should have a beam, you should have a baseline greater than around 2,000 kilometers. You should use the wideband beam. You've got that whole energy range. At least as long as you can have resolution on the energy so that you know what the spectrum is, okay, and you don't have real background problems killing you, this is a much more efficient way of doing this rather than mounting a new experiment at all of these different distances. Okay, the physics potential is sort of listed here. We have, like I said, the ability to potentially do everything. Nature may be cruel and we only get a bound on this. Let me show you what things might actually look like. Well, let me just show you this one because of the question you asked. Here's what things actually look like with matter. All right? And with matter, you see, in the 3 to 5 GeV region, with the regular hierarchy, we get a huge signal. And with the other hierarchy, we would get zero, basically. So we can't miss that. No minutes left. So let me give you my opinion, because opinion is like a question, I guess, on all of this. The world needs probably really double what I'm talking about, 1,000 kiloton water Cherenkov detector, if we really want to move forward on proton decay to get to 10 to the 36 years, all right? But my solution is to have a 500 kiloton detector in Japan and a 500 kiloton detector in the United States. This is one of the few projects where you can collaborate together and both countries get the project. Nobody loses in all of this. In addition, the engineering is such that this is humanly possible for one country, and this is humanly possible for one country, but the sum may not be, it seems to me. The sum is very, very difficult. So this cries out for an international collaboration. In addition, if you're doing supernova physics, we heard a very interesting talk where it looked like even with limited statistics, there was a matter of fact that differentiated IMB and Kamiokande. Imagine looking at that kind of matter effect with 100,000 events in each detector. So you probably, for supernova, are better off breaking the detector up into two pieces like this in different parts of the world. We already know what they can do on atmospheric neutrinos, and they'll do much, much better for that. And they'll have this whole program ahead of them. This thing is to have a lifetime of 50 to 100 years. Okay, you're not going to build something this big underground and leave it after 5 or 6 years. So it's going to do a lot of physics, have some potentially major discoveries, I would say. In addition, its cost, as I said, is too prohibitive for just neutrino oscillations. But $800 million or so for a whole program does not sound outrageous. Right. In addition, the facility, for example, if it's at home stake, would be a facility not only for physics, but for the public. People who are talking about an underground laboratory talk about public outreach. Every family that goes to Mount Rushmore to visit in the summer will stop by the National Laboratory's IMAX theater, where they'll see the movie, The Story of the Neutrino and Neutrino Oscillations, and Ray Davis will be the hero that everybody will grow up to try and imitate and work hard all of their lives. So it's an idea, it seems to me, that not only should it appeal to people here who are physicists, but should appeal to the public, something we usually disregard. Having this facility and everything above ground with tourists looking at it and wanting to learn from it is a great thing for our field. So I would say we can't afford not to do something like this. Well, will it catch on? For that, I don't have a complete answer. Just stay tuned. Thank you. Well, I'm buying land myself in that area, just in case, but...
What's the great motivation for atmospheric neutrinos to have a much bigger detector?
Well, right now, if you've seen their data, it just comes down and shows a depletion of a half. It doesn't show any of the oscillation structure in it, the peaks.
Do you need to go to lower energy to see that, rather than higher?
No, the peaks will occur at... a few GeV or so muon energies, and you want the bigger detector has a couple of advantages. One is that the events at those energies will be contained in the detector, okay? And so they claim, they've done studies, that they'll see the oscillation structure if they go to this big detector. So a very interesting thing would be to compare their determination of the delta M squared through the peaks with the accelerator one to see if they're the same. Okay, because they would be more affected by theta 1-3 than the accelerator, for example, because they have all of this stuff happening with NUIs. So all of those studies might look like overkill. Why are we measuring with accelerators and the atmosphere, the oscillation pattern of NUMU disappearance? But they're under very different conditions. And those are the kinds of sort of over-constrained determinations we want to have to really make comparisons.
Quasi-elastic events, aren't those a small fraction when you get up to 5 GeV?
And all of the numbers that I showed only used the quasi-elastic events. That's right. With quasi-elastic, we had in total something like 16,000 events. Full, all events, we have about 60,000 events. Some people are doing a study to see whether you can use the other events to tell you something. We can't use them as nicely as we use the quasi-elastic, so we are giving up something in acceptance by using them, but we claim we can still do it without the others. But the others are there, and they're oscillating, and maybe we'll be able to use them, but we're making no claims on the basis of the other events.
Can you really separate quasi-elastic event from
Sure. Quasi-elastic events has an isolated muon or electron in it, nothing else. That's what you see. The other events have other activity in them. Well, we have pi zeros. Our main background is neutral current events that just produce a single isolated pi zero. That's the dominant, just as in super K, that's the dominant background.
But
What's happening is the following. We agree there are lots of pi zeros as a background. What we disagree with other people on is we claim most of the pi zeros are below 1 GeV. Below 1 GeV, you can identify a lot of the pi zeros. Once in a while, you misidentify one as an electron, and we're counting that as a background. Above 1 GeV, you can't identify pi zeros as easily, and that's a background, but we contend there aren't many above 1 GeV, and that's why we can do things above 1 GeV. That's our contention.
Bill, you implied that the only theoretical prejudice about theta 1-3 is that it's zero.
No.
There's a very, very plausible model that suggests 7 or 8 degrees.
Yeah, but you know, why do you build those models? Because somebody measures theta 1-3, they say it's kind of small, so you say, let me build a model that starts out with it being small. Well, you know, if you take that approach, it's going to be small, it seems to me. And it might be very small, but am I supposed to believe that?
It's not a totally fair comment, actually.
Well,
read is an element of that.
Okay.
I didn't understand the remark about building a hill instead of digging a hole. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I wasn't kidding when I said nobody's going to allow us to have a beam dump 11 degrees down and 200 meters on Long Island. In addition, it's very expensive to build slopes of 11 degrees. So this beam line is particularly, could be expensive. Now, this is an idea I stole from the neutrino factory people, because they realized it would be very hard for them to put their whole storage ring underground as well. So they said they'll put it on a hill with a slope, and that's what they intended to do. So if they can put the whole storage ring on a slope, we said we can put a beam line on a slope. And so we costed, how expensive is it to get bulldozers to push up sand and make a slope that comes down at 11 degrees and goes up at about 11?
I can't picture it.
Okay, I have the picture, which I'm happy to show. These guys gave me more. All right, so here's the picture. Now, here's for what this is worth. Maybe I'll say north for me. So here's the AGS. There's a beam line that already exists that you extract the beam from. You take it around, you go up the hill and down the hill into a beam dump, and then your beam goes in at 11 degrees. So that's how it works there.
So you use a lot of magnets?
Oh yeah, the bending of this beam, it's not trivial, but it's part of the cost. Yeah, no, this you can...
That's well understood.
Oh yeah, yeah. All of this technology is very straightforward. There's no problem with that. Our problem here, because I don't want to hide anything, is a near detector. It's very hard for us to put a detector 1 kilometer away where we would like to, because it goes too deep. And so we're probably going to have a detector, because we need some detector there, that's closer than we would have liked to have. That's what this part is. It's a near detector underground. But this thing's going at 11 degrees. All of this hill is made with bulldozers, and we've costed that, and it costs you about $20 million to make the hill.
you say it's 15 stories high?
It's, I think it's roughly, no, maybe less. Maybe it's less. What do I have written there? I don't have it written now. Radiation?
Yeah.
Near the beam dump, the stop. The beam stop will be a little bit into the ground. A little bit. That's not a big deal. No, none of that's a big deal.
So how do you distinguish quasi-elastic from inter-elastic?
You only look for an isolated lepton in the final state.
But, I mean, what would Cherenkov look at? If you are below the emission of Cherenkov light, you will not see...
Well, there's some, that doesn't happen very often, that you get a high energy lepton in a deep inelastic event and very little else that emits energy that you would see. I mean, this technology has been well studied. I mean, we have three generations of water Cherenkov detectors. They've done atmospheric neutrinos over a variety of energies. So one knows how good the degree of identification of quasi-elastic is. It's not a problem. It's a little bit of background, but it's very tiny.
I'm sure that there are a lot of questions, but time is up, so let's thank you.
Sure.
And as the chairman of the last session, I'd like to propose everybody to thank all the organizers and the staff that are here for holding such a great meeting.